Welcome to Physicians Weekly.
Welcome to this episode of Physicians Weekly podcast. I am your host, Dr. Rachel Giles from Medical Medical Publishers, in collaboration with Physicians Weekly. This episode, we have two really interesting interviews. Physicians Weekly's editorial board member, Alex McDonald, MD, interviews Kavita Arora, MD, who's the Division Director of General Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine. And she talks about how to flip the narrative that providing abortion service is healthcare in light of the Dobbs verdict overturning Roe versus Wade. This interview with Dr. Arora is a straight shooter, and she calls it as she sees it.
I'm not sure if I would say that the measures are well-intended. I think they are misogynistic and controlling of women. They invade patient-clinician privacy and the sacred relationship that happens in my exam room.
But first, Physicians Weekly Senior Editor Marta Kelly speaks with Dr. Osama Amro, Director of the Swedish Polycystic Kidney Disease Center in Seattle, Washington, about their multidisciplinary patient-centered approach to pain management strategies in the management of autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease, or ADPKD. ADPKD is one of the most common genetic diseases in humans, affecting 1 in 400 individuals, and it's the fourth most common cause of renal failure across the world. If one parent has ADPKD, the children have a 50% chance of inheriting the gene, though up to 10% of those patients don't have any family history at all and have de novo mutations. Pain management is central to progressive ADPKD as the cysts grow and the weight of the kidneys can affect other systems. Dr. Amro provides practical tips on both pharmacological and non-pharmacological approaches. Enjoy listening.
Good day. Today I'm here with Osama Amro, MD-MS, who is the director of the Swedish Polycystic Kidney Disease Center of Excellence at Swedish Medical Center in Seattle. He is also board certified in internal medicine and nephrology. Welcome, doctor.
Thank you very much.
What makes gaps in pain management for patients with ADPKD an important topic to study? What needs existed for your research?
You know, I think this is important to point out that there is a gap between what we try to address as physicians and what really affect the patient. So many times there is a disconnect. So patients will be suffering from a day-to-day pain, discomfort, interfering with the quality of their life. And many times our focus as physicians will be focusing on the kidney function. So there, you see there is a disconnect. So what is matter for the patient might not be the same page which the physician. So I think we are trying to connect the physicians and the patients to the disease aspects that affect the patient most. And because this disease is common, as you know, around 140,000 patients with ADPKD lives in the United States. So this disease really have a high burden for the patient and the society. A lot of these patients will suffer from pain. And a lot of the time they are underreporting. You know, we don't typically ask about the pain in a routine visit. So a patient could go, you know, many months without reporting pain, discomfort. So if we don't look for it, we are unlikely to manage it appropriately.
Can you briefly explain what you and your colleagues do to set out with the study and how you went about conducting it?
Very good. So our hope is to provide a multidisciplinary approach with a focus on the patient. So when the patient walks to our center, we ask him the questions, you know, how did you learn about the disease? What's the family history? And then the very next question is, how is the disease affecting your day-to-day life? It is really important because if somebody is aware of the disease just because of screening ultrasound, it's totally different from somebody who is suffering from the disease day in and day out. So it is really important to bring this into focus and revolve the management strategy around this, the most important aspect of the disease for the patient. So once we identify how the disease affects the patient, you know, we craft this management plan accordingly. So obviously, we all look into delaying the kidney failure or preventing kidney failure. But at the same time, we want to try to manage or reduce the burden of the disease, including kidney pain, blood in the urine, and discomfort.
What findings from your study are important to stress to our physician readers, particularly nephrologists?
The most important aspect of our approach is management ADPKD is there is under management of pain in patient ADBKD. So patients are not satisfied with their management. It is interfering with their quality of life. They are missing a lot of days in at work. They are visiting ER multiple times. And a lot of the time, they are skipping activities just because they are in pain. So I think the GAB is the most important aspect that we identify in our approach of multidisciplinary patient-focused approach. So once we identify the GAB, then we go through a strategy in which we identify a strategy for pain management. And we will go through this in details. So if the patient comes to us with pain, it's a continuous pain affecting their quality of life, we put a strategy. The strategy always starts with non-pharmacological approach. That means trying to manage the pain without medication first. And that includes binder, wearing a corset, avoiding high heels, strengthening the core, and avoiding certain activities that can bring the pain. Heat pad also can be helpful, as many times the pain is related to the hyperlordosis. That means exaggeration of the normal curvature of the spine just because of the pressure that the kidney put on the patient. So with managing back pain with heat pads, with corset, and many times that will be effective. If this strategy is only partially successful or not successful or enough to alleviate the pain, then we move to pharmacological treatment. And we try at the beginning with a mild medication like Tylenol or acetaminophen. This is with the least risky medication. And we try to manage this with the medication. Occasionally, we use non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medication. However, I want to caution you and the audience that this should be used with extreme caution if there is a decrease in kidney function, which many times happen for in late ADBKD. If this strategy is still not successful, then we move to a stronger pain medication, and that includes sparingly using some opioids. We try to alleviate the pain after extensive counseling on when to use the opioid as a last resort and minimize the use as much as possible. A lot of time we resort into the help of our pain clinic, and they provide a continuous management approach for these patients. If the above is not working, so we go with the next step by either draining the cyst that's causing the pain. That can be due with minimal surgery or aspiration through interventional radiology. A lot of time that can relieve the pain that's contributing to the patient discomfort and impaired quality of life.
And finally, what would you like to see future research focus on in this area? What needs still exist?
That is really an important question. The more we learn to focus our attention to patient-reported outcome, the better we become a researcher, scientist, and physicians. There is a disconnect. It's not only a gap in ADBKD management of pain. It is a gap on how we look at the diseases, chronic disease in general. The outcome we are looking at typically is the disease-related outcome. The patient's outcome that's really bothered them is what affects their quality of life. And we have to bring these together. If we are able to bring these together, we really improve the quality of life. It is really no point to improving the numbers if the quality of the life for the patients are not improved. So we really need to work hand in hand. One important aspect to remember that a lot of these diseases, managing the disease itself will improve the quality of life associated with the disease progression. So any strategy that can reduce the progression of ADBKD will eventually reduce or alleviate some of the pain. However, we have to put this into perspective with the focus on the patient's quality of life and reported outcome.
Well, thank you very much. This is very informative. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Physician Weekly Podcast. I'm really excited for our guest today. Dr. Aurora is an OBGYN from North Carolina, and we are going to talk about abortion access and abortion care and some of the recent Supreme Court rulings today. And so this should hopefully be interesting and high yield for all of you out there. So, Dr. Aurora, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me, Alex.
Awesome. Well, tell me who you are and what you do to start with.
Yeah, sure. Alex, I am a OBGYN in North Carolina. I'm a general OBGYN, and I also have a background in bioethics as well as health disparities.
Wonderful. Excellent. Tell us, you know, obviously there's been a lot in the news recently with the Supreme Court ruling striking down Roe v. Wade and sort of what that means for patients and for physicians and other clinicians who provide abortion care services. And so tell us kind of what this means from kind of a larger health policy point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's important to note that the impact of Dobbs cannot be overstated, and it will have impact in various fields. So this will impact our clinical practice, this will impact medical education, it will impact research, and it will also impact healthcare employment.
What does it mean specifically for patients also?
Yeah, clinically, the United States already has a crisis in terms of maternal morbidity and mortality, and overturning Roe will only make that worse. We are going to see more women get very hurt because of pregnancy, during pregnancy, and as a result of labor. This will be especially true for patients that are Black or Brown, currently marginalized or minoritized by society, such as those that are LGBT, live in rural areas, are low income, and students will also be really impacted by this decision. Outside of sort of quote unquote just abortion care, this also impacts our ability to take care of patients with ectopic pregnancies, patients with PPROM or preterm previable rupture of membranes, preeclampsia in the second trimester. It's important to remember that even quote unquote low risk birth is not a thing. Being low risk is really a retrospective diagnosis that I can't make until the postpartum visit. It is statistically safer to have a first trimester abortion than it is to carry a pregnancy to term. So by forcing patients to have to carry, we are actively harming them. This also impacts fertility treatments, especially IVF, impacts our ability to provide other clinical care. We're hearing stories of patients around the country not being able to access drugs like misoprostol that are not being used for abortion, but are being used for other clinical reasons because pharmacists are worried about state laws in those states. It will impact surgery for pregnant patients. So if you have an appendicitis and you're pregnant, now all of a sudden the general surgeon has to worry about state laws regarding pregnancy care when before it simply would have just been good medical practice to take out the appendix.
You touched on so many points there, which we could probably go into ad nauseum, but you touched on a couple points that, you know, I've heard stories about physicians, particularly in some of these states, which have now kind of even more restrictive laws around abortion and women's health care. They will often have lawyers on retainer and they will call the lawyer sometimes before they do anything because they're so afraid of losing their license. I remember there was one OBGYN who I heard interviewed saying, you know, she's no good to anybody if she loses her medical license for trying to provide what she thinks is evidence-based ethical care, which then is seen in retrospect by the courts as illegal, for lack of a better term. Physicians aren't able to practice the way they were trained and what they were trained to do and to take care of the patient in front of them. They have to call a lawyer before they even make any medical decisions. That's just mind-boggling to me as a physician who spent, you know, the first 30 plus years of my life in school and training to be able to make these decisions.
Absolutely. It is insulting and it is infuriating. I've already heard from colleagues around the country that this is leading to moral distress. This is worsening their burnout. Mm-hmm. And they are in agony about how they are supposed to fulfill their oath, their duty to care for the patient in front of them when they have a real risk of being sued, of ending up in jail. And they have to balance their hat and their oath as a physician to the hats that they wear as a, you know, parent, as a partner, as a responsible member of society and being able to care for the next patient, as you said. And I think that is a terrible place to put physicians and put OBGYNs. And it really is infuriating that in laws where these dates were passed, that there hasn't been explicit guidance for physicians to carve out some of these things that nobody thinks is controversial, right? Nobody in evidence-based healthcare thinks treatment of an ectopic pregnancy is not warranted. Nobody thinks, you know, IVF shouldn't happen, or I should say very rare, right? Like these things are not controversial. They're not the basis of the political action. And yet allowing these to remain in sort of shades of gray puts real patients at risk and puts real doctors at risk.
Yeah, I think that's such a valid point. And we know that, as you mentioned earlier, that the maternal morbidity in this country is really embarrassing, quite frankly, to be the United States of America in this day and age, particularly in rural areas where the maternal mortality and risk is mind-bogglingly high compared to the state of our nation and the ability and our technological advancements in care. And again, just further exacerbating this with a lot of these sort of implementations which are imposed on us from legislators who, you know, they may be well-intended, but they just don't understand what medicine is or the practice of medicine too, which obviously causes a lot of other issues, to say the least.
Yeah, I think, I'm not sure if I would say that the measures are well-intended. I think they are misogynistic and controlling of women. They invade patient-clinician privacy and the sacred relationship that happens in my exam room, in exam rooms of my colleagues. And there really shouldn't be any political or legislative interference in the practice of medicine, especially by those that are not licensed to practice it, like politicians. But even if you acknowledge that there's controversy around abortion, these state laws are not the way to handle that philosophical disagreement. Mm-hmm. There are other ways to handle it. And as you mentioned, this will only actively harm women, their families, and the communities that they live in. It is not lost on anyone that the states that have trigger laws, that have bans on abortions, mm-hmm. are also the states that already have worse maternal morbidity and mortality rates than other states. Yeah. And so these are going hand in hand. And I think it's really important that we as states and we as a country decide whether we care enough about women to do something about it.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. And thank you for specifically calling that out. When I say well-intended, I'm trying to be kind, I guess, and trying to extend an olive branch. Has this impacted you at all in your practice in any specific way?
Yeah, it has. So North Carolina is one of the quote-unquote safer states in the Southeast, for now at least. We did have a ban passed so that abortion is no longer permitted, with few exceptions, including for maternal health after 20 weeks and 6 days in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And people will say, well, great, that's lovely. Like, why would somebody need an abortion after that? But I think it's important to remember that we're also having an access to care issue. Mm-hmm. It is really hard for me to get patients in for their anatomy scans before 20 weeks, which yeah. would leave you with very few days if you have a major anomaly diagnosed to make an incredibly difficult decision that nobody goes into pregnancy wanting to make if you have a, you know, an anomalous fetus of what to do with that pregnancy. Also, and just the other day, I had a patient with PPROM, the preterm premature rupture of membranes. And it left us in the position of having to figure out what we can do. She wasn't septic yet, and so we couldn't do anything. We actively had to wait until she became septic in order to do something for her.
Wow.
And it is really hard to ignore evidence-based practice simply because you have to worry about being able to take care of the next patient, being able to provide for your family, not wanting to end up in jail. And I can't even imagine what my colleagues in states with much, much more restrictive laws are facing. And my heart goes out to them.
Yeah, no, I think that's just a valid point. I mean, to me, as a family medicine physician, you know, practicing, you know, preventative care, right? The goal is to prevent issues before they come up, not have to wait until they get so bad that then you're legally allowed to treat them as opposed to prevent them in the first place. So I think all your points are so well taken. What can we do? What can we do as physicians, as the public, to really reclaim, one, the narrative regarding this, and also just ensure that our laws are not restricting us from really practicing evidence-based medicine and evidence-based reproductive care?
Yeah. First, I think, as you mentioned, I think reclaiming the narrative is so important. This has been framed as a fringe issue, one that affects only a few people, one that affects only, you know, women who need or want abortions. And I think that couldn't be further from the truth. First of all, a third of women in America have or will have an abortion at some point in their life. So it's not just a few people. And second, this impacts so much more than that, right? It impacts you if you have a patient, if you have a person in your life who's capable of pregnancy, mm-hmm. Which hopefully should be all of us. And if there is interference in one aspect of medicine, there can be interference in all aspects of medicine. I would hope that patients as a whole, our communities as a whole, and especially the healthcare field as a whole and medicine as a whole would stand together on this. I was really impressed by our work together, Alex, you and I, and many others in the American Medical Association, to see the entire House of Medicine take a stand. And I think that is unprecedented. And I think really symbolizes how important this is to healthcare as a whole. So I think we have to flip the narrative that abortion is healthcare. And second, I think we have to put sort of our time and money where our mouths are, right? So getting out the vote, donating to candidates if we're able to, showing conservative candidates that they've often used sort of abortion as like a party line, that this no longer is a party line, right? It is a litmus test. Either you care about more than half of this country's population or you don't. And you can't sort of just say it and vote differently. You have to actually mean it, and there will be consequences saying in action.
Yeah, no, that's great. So many different ways that we can all, you know, do a small part. It feels a little bit overwhelming sometimes. We're not legislating the practice of medicine, which I think is very, very dangerous and a very slippery slope. But also at the same time, you know, reaching out to help our colleagues in other states as well, too, and everyone doing what we can. That's really, really a great call out. So is there any other thoughts or closing thoughts you want to leave us with?
Yeah. And just to your last point of being in a safe state, I think one of the things that is really struck me is the disparities that this decision will have. And it's come up in counseling at the bedside, right? When patients are like, what will this mean to me when I have an anatomy ultrasound at 20 weeks? And I have to honestly look at them and be like, this may not mean much to you because you have the ability to fly to a different place, right? Or this really is going to mean something to you. And that is really sickening at the bedside. And there are travel funds for patients that are set up through societies that are in this space. And so I would encourage those that do have resources, if you're looking for what can you do that will make a tangible difference, is and you don't need to sort of worry about your local politics, that that is definitely a way that you can have an impact on the healthcare disparities that we'll see because of Dobbs.
Thank you so much. This has been really fascinating. This will all spur us to have this conversation amongst, you know, each other and our colleagues and at the dinner table, even with maybe some fellow members who may not agree with us, because I think ultimately we all need to have this conversation and it's not something that we can just sort of ignore. Sometimes it feels like there's a stigma. You can't talk about these things, but I think we all need to sort of break out of that mindset and continue to have the conversation and continue to work to really, you know, protect the health of 50% of our population, if not more.
Well, thanks, Alex. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for joining us, and thanks everyone for listening.
That's all the time we have for today's podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe and stay healthy.
Physicians Weekly is produced in collaboration with Medicom Medical Publishers and Physicians Weekly.